So then he just talks about, you know, Master gives us other pictures of the life of Lahiri, based on the family friend who stayed there for weeks at a time and talked about how Lahiri would just meditate in his living room all the time, and in the middle of the night, sadhus and yogis would come, and you just have this wonderful sense of the spiritual network in which people sense and hear and know about. I mean, the world doesn't know he was there because the world didn't care. But people who are spiritually inclined discovered him and tell each other, and God tells them, and they just come and find him. And this is also, you know, this is really when Kali Yuga was still more powerful. We've come now into the time when Dwapara is more in the ascendant, and so things are more open. But Lahiri received this teaching from Babaji in the Himalayas, and the openness of it was just beginning. You know, it wasn't at the time yet where it could be advertised. We advertise Kriya Yoga. But when Lahiri was still coming out of the Kali Yuga time, when these teachings had to be protected from the diluting influence of the world. So it was just him in his living room very quietly and in the middle of the night, and having his disciples not even speak of what they had learned to anyone, because it was more free than having to go all the way to Babaji to get it, but it was far more constricted than it finally became when Yogananda got to America, because we were still in a transition stage. The plant was younger and it had to be protected a little bit more. But again, you just have this picture of this soul just being there all the time, and the little room in which he sat was maybe about the size or a little smaller than our small classroom over in the teaching center. A little smaller than that. Not a very big room, just right off the main courtyard, and then there's this little platform area where Lahiri would sit day and night. Just a dais, just a small platform, flat. Probably it was padded somewhat, but he would just sit there and people would come in and just sit and meditate with him. Just as unpretentious and as humble as you could possibly conceive of without being impoverished. And it wasn't impoverished, but it was just totally plain. And even the picture of Lahiri Mahashaya, you know, the one picture that he had taken, the one there is actually, that I've actually learned this is all the expose, that's not actually the photograph, that's actually a painting of the photograph that's up there. The actual photograph of Lahiri looks considerably different, and when we change our altar, we'll put it up there. This is the painting of Lahiri done from the photograph by Sananda Ghosh in 1956, as Surf switched it. And most people just didn't even really know. And he wasn't wearing any cloth over him. And when he really had his picture taken, he was bare-chested, and he had on this little dhoti, this little funky sort of dhoti. Even in the original photograph, it's just a really funky piece of cloth, and he's sitting here like this, and the cloth that comes between his legs is kind of just all kind of shredded, and Lahiri's hair is a little like this, and he's, like many yogis, he's quite big in the chest, and like many devotional men, he has virtually breasts like a woman. And then this is the picture for the ages. He just goes, sits like this. That's really what it looked like. And it was just so perfectly unconcerned with anything. It was so much so that SR substituted this. In which he has this beautiful cloth draped around him, and even the cloth that's there is all sort of painted, and it all looks a little, you know, a lot more elegant and so on. And he just didn't at all. Because it just, what difference did it make? It just didn't make any difference. He was just there to give Kriya. You know, just to pass that on. That's all that mattered. It's so marvelous just to take our lives and just bring it back to that, just as much as we can. You know, one photograph for the ages, and that's just what he looked like. Pardon me?
Do you think that room was open when he was there?
The gate?
I don't remember any door being there.
There's a grate there now. I mean, like an iron sort of door. Oh, yes, of course it was open. People just came and went. What Benicia is saying is that the way the family kept it, you go into the courtyard, you can stand at the doorway to that room, but they don't let you in the room. Family's a good bit more restrictive than Harry was. And then you have a few remarkable stories about Lahiri with this Aboya who stopped the train. You have also the picture of the fact that the masters involve themselves on levels you don't expect them to involve you. You know, she doesn't want to wait to see him, but there was must have been something so powerful in her heart's desire to be with him that Lahiri stopped the train. And yet at the same time he teases her, oh, you could have taken the next train. It wasn't necessary for you to be so upset about it. But then she prays for a child, and Lahiri helps her with the child. So again, it also, even though on one hand, you know, we're talking about this renunciation and this great freedom, she asks her guru to help that the child will be okay, and he helps that the child is okay. Because the masters have this great sympathy for our human condition. They stand in this strange sort of dual relationship to our reality. On one hand, it's just such a dream. What difference does it make? It's exactly the way Swamiji once described it, when a child, a little child, will bring you their dolly. You know, oh, my dolly is unhappy, you know, because it didn't get to do this, and its arm is broken. And you just don't say, oh, come on, that's just a stupid piece of fluff. You know, you pick it up and you say, oh, here, let me help Dolly, and I'll dress her, and that'll make her better now, and we'll fix her little arm up. Is that better, darling? And the little girl says, oh, yeah, I'm so happy now, and you go off. And the parent knows it's just been a fantasy, but it isn't a fantasy to the child. It's a real, they're having a real emotional experience in relationship to it. And the master recognizes, just like the parent recognizes, that you'll help the child more by running it through than by trying to force the child to a level of understanding the child isn't ready for. You know? So the disciple comes and says, I really want this baby to live. And it's her karma to have the baby live. So instead of Lahiri saying, oh, it's all a delusion, get over it. You know, which is what pseudo-spiritual people do. You know, one of the ways you can tell true teachers from false is simple things like kindness and compassion. Pretend teachers who are more ego than real often force people to sort of into an unnatural level of renunciation that doesn't allow them to grow at their own pace. So again, in a simple story like this, you get a picture of what a true avatar does. It meant a great deal. This poor woman had 8 babies die. And you could see it was just very important, help me. But he asked something of her and even broke into it in the night. Be careful, the lamp's going out. Because what you finally learn from these masters is love and friendship. We have a very hard time appreciating how much God loves us and how personal and supportive and profoundly concerned about us Divine Mother really is. And so we have these divine examples of true friendship, and they show us, they awaken us to the potential of true friendship, and then we can believe in it, and that gives us the faith to believe in God. That's the example of Master's life. That's really been the example of Swami in our lives. I mean, I realized one day that I actually believed in Divine Mother's love because I had experienced Swami Kriyananda's friendship. I mean, I had just experienced someone who really would be a friend. And so the reality of that kind of love was an experience to me. And therefore, I didn't doubt that it could exist. You understand? That's just like, even like a child who has a very difficult upbringing has to put out a lot of willpower to trust the world after that. And so us, as poor, battered little jivas through all of these awful incarnations where everything just falls apart as it always does, we sort of lose hope in divine goodness. And the masters come, the example of Christ and the story of Yogananda and the inner experience we have, to touch us on a level that helps us to understand that we can have faith. Does that make sense? And so these little stories, like these little stories of how far Lahiri Mahashaya went to just help this woman, who was just, you know, by all apparent standards, just an ordinary woman. But he reached out so far to help her because that's what Divine Mother does. You know, because it's through that kind of love that we grow, not through being rejected. Yes.
As opposed to just telling her, okay, your child will live, why
would you go through all that with the lamp and so on? I mean, you can guess. There's a story elsewhere in the autobiography, isn't there, where Lahiri gives Sri Yukteswar the little bit of oil that he has to pour down the throat of his dead friend in order to bring his friend back to life. Sometimes, in order to activate the devotee's will, they give you something to do because it's also in the focus of your own will that the power finds an instrument. And so that must be part of it. So he challenged her and had to wake her up. Also, it makes a better story. I mean, it's illustrative, and it, you know, it's happening for a purpose. I don't know. In the Bible, when Yogananda comments on the different miracles of Jesus, I used to teach this in more detail and had it in my head. I don't now. But Master talks about the different ways in which Jesus healed people. And Master talks about how each one of them was healing for a different temperament. The servant, the soldier comes and says his daughter is sick and Jesus can heal her. He doesn't even have to come. He just can say she is well, and the soldier knows that she'll be well. Because the soldier had so much faith in Christ that it wasn't necessary even to demonstrate it. To one sick person, he said, "You know, pick up your bed." And Yogananda says that, you know, that disciple had to put out energy himself. He had to act on the faith that he had. He had to do it himself. He had to show that I believe I am well. I will make this action. As distinct from the soldier who just had to be told and knew it was true. And sometimes Christ himself would use strong words, you know, to drive the illness out, rebuke to the fever in the case of the mother of one of his disciples. There was a strong word, the power to send it out, which all again related to the consciousness of the disciple. So it's a very interesting study. I mean, you just think, so he says one thing or another, you don't think it's meaningful, but in fact, everything is a teaching. That's why Swamiji said, for these more than 50 years, he's meditated on everything he can remember that Yogananda said. The word, he said, the way he tilted his head, the tone of voice, the look in his eye, because every part of it, sometimes years later, he realized it had deep meaning. It wasn't a small thing at all. Swami just wrote recently about a particular woman that had been a devotee there that Master used to often fiercely criticize in front of Swamiji. I mean, not in front of others, but he would say very, very critical things. And Swami said she was attempting to edit Yogananda's work, but she was changing his ideas. She wasn't respecting his ideas. And Yogananda spent a great deal of time telling Swamiji how much he disliked what this woman was doing, even though Master was not at all inclined to speak negatively. But he really wanted Swami to understand. And so, I mean, it wasn't lost on Swami at the time, but as the years have passed and Swami has begun to edit Master's words, he really, you know, profoundly hears Yogananda's voice explicitly speaking about what that woman wasn't doing correctly. Because Swami himself was, in a sense, too young to be told how to do it. because it was just so, it was a task so far beyond Swamiji to actually edit Yogananda's commentaries, even though that was what he was going to do. But yet, Master had to plant in his mind in such a way that he could hear it and understand it, the thoughts that he was going to need later when he was ready. And so you just don't know what's happening. That's why even just an autobiography of a yogi, there's just a sentence here. That's why it's so good. This is to read these over and over, because you just, all of a sudden you know something you didn't know before, because you weren't ready to know it. But there it is waiting for you. Any other questions or thoughts? The last part of this chapter, which I've talked about Tarlanga Swami a number of times, so I don't necessarily need to go over it again, but the last part of it is just this last whole story about this other yogi Christ of India, which is this remarkable Tarlanga Swami, and just how completely bizarre he is. And it's also just a great story in the sense that lest we ever take the image of the infinite and try to make him comfortable for us. You know, we have this 300-pound naked man who just wandered around. And we, instead of, we get this picture of what saints are supposed to look like, and they're supposed to look like movie stars and, you know, be nice in the ways that we want them to be. And instead, you just have this realization that these people are so much larger than life and so much more eccentric and so much more free. And it's necessary to... You can't be a really good devotee unless you have a willingness to be a little unconventional. You know, and the more that we can rejoice in the unconventionality of it, the more freedom it gives to our own mind to be really creative and original. Whether our lives show or not, within ourselves we have to have this great freedom. And so Tarlanga Swami is just this wonderful story of just remarkable eccentricity. What a character. What a story. So, that's about all I'm going to say tonight. Anything more? Okay. So I don't know what the next assignment is, but I bet you do. And if you don't, you can call and ask somebody. I don't know what comes next. Okay, thank you. Pardon me? So it's Rama raised from the dead, and Babaji, the yogi Christ of modern India, seems worth doing. All right.